We'd like to thank our podcast sponsor, Dodd Camera, for their support of The Outspoken Cyclist. There is a close relationship between cycling and photography, and we're proud to have this family-owned business as a partner in our show. If you're in the market for photo equipment, want to learn more about taking great pictures, or maybe you're ready to launch your own YouTube channel, visit doddcamera.com and see what Dodd Camera can do for you. Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly radio connection to bicycles and cycling, as well as fitness and other related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist is a radio show produced by cyclists for cyclists. And now here's your host, the Outspoken Cyclist herself, Diane Lees.
Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Lees. Tim is off this week. Actually, he's down at Clemson with the Cleveland Rowing Group of some sort. Anyway, I'm about to head down to Ridgeland, Mississippi for the Ridgeland OBO Tandem Rally this coming weekend. So far, there are 39 teams registered for the event. The weather's looking great, and we are very much looking forward to being away and riding in warmer weather, you know, like not jackets and tights and long-fingered gloves. It'll be fun. So our show this week begins with a new conversation with Chef Bijou Thomas, whose Feed Zone cookbook series has a new member. The Feed Zone Table is the title of his newest book, and it's not just a cookbook. Rather, it's a well-thought-out discourse on life and sport and food and how each interact with the others. As it turns out, athletes, particularly those who find themselves on the road in foreign places, are often lonely and homesick. The Feed Zone Table delves into this, as well as how and why a family-style meal can make a huge difference for all of us. Bijou, along with his partner, Alan Lim, give us 100 brand-new recipes, as well as some sound philosophy and science in this beautifully illustrated and photographed hardbound book. It is really a heavy book. It's a good one to have on your shelf. I'm pretty excited about talking with Bijou again. And we'll also talk a little bit about his store's Little Curry Shop. He's about to open two more after the wildly successful one in Denver. So we'll take a break after we talk with Bijou. We'll do a little news. And then we're going to head down to North Carolina to talk with Velo News' Dan Wuori. This week saw the loss of yet another pro cyclist when Antoine Desmottier was hit by a motorbike at Ghent. And I hope this I say this right, correctly. Wevelgem. The dangers for cyclists in the pro peloton seem to be just exploding at an alarming rate. We're going to discuss this with Dan, along with how the spring classics are coming along in spite of the tragedy this week. So out to Denver we go to talk with Chef Bijou Thomas about his new book, The Feed Zone Table. Bijou, thanks for joining me this evening. Welcome back to The Outspoken Cyclist.
Thank you so much for having me again.
This book is really different from the other two, the Feed Zone Cookbook and the Feed Zone Portables. It's not just a cookbook. It's a reflection sort of on life. Tell us a little bit how you and Alan came up with this book.
Yeah, you know, this book, it was in the works since way before we wrote any books. Alan had started working with athletes way back in the day, I think, 2006, 2007-ish, and then he and I started working together 2009-ish. It's something that Al had always noticed, which was, regardless of what the food was or what the event was, just getting everybody together was probably the best part of the day. And we started observing that more and more with athletes and teams that we worked with. I remember working with the Radio Shack team back in, tour of California, maybe 2009-ish, I think, and noticed, or 2010 probably, noticing that there was a bunch of the riders, you know, pro tour riders that are professional riders for decades, or pro riders for at least the last 10, 15 years, on the same team. They didn't really know a lot about each other because they see each other a couple of races here and there. And then, I don't know, for the listeners that haven't been to a big pro tour race, a lot of the meals are in one big hall or dining facility whenever possible. But the teams are kind of, you know, they keep to themselves. They don't talk to each other. They, you know, the mechanics and staff sit here and the riders sit here. Everybody eats really quietly because each team, you'll have multiple different languages and cultures, all this other stuff. People would kind of get up and eat their meal and then they would go their way. And we noticed that just out of necessity, there were a couple of times we didn't have access to a kitchen or we didn't have space for everyone to sit. We started getting the guys together and they were just happy and laughing and talking. And then you would see them writing differently and writing better. And it was like they were writing with their friends little by little. And then we started creating that as a big part of our what we did feeding them way before, you know, we even started Scratch Labs. It was just, we liked feeding the guys and hanging out with them, seeing them hang out with each other, and it kind of helped create that culture of it.
Well, I think people don't understand how these teams come together and how important food is. It sort of is, and I hate to use this as a metaphor, but the glue that kind of holds it all together.
Yeah, absolutely, because for the riders that are at the top end of the sport, the pro tour riders, you know, they get there. It's kind of a very lonely kind of life because, you know, they spend the bulk of their time either they're riding their bike, training, racing, or they're in a hotel room. There's very little in the form of a social life at that level of the sport because they got to protect, you know, any reserves of energy they've got, any avoid getting into any injuries or any other trouble, or make sure they get enough sleep. The European teams, they run a very, very strict programs where the riders are usually, even the big time, big superstar riders are, somebody's watching them constantly, making sure that they're not drifting off to get a glass of wine or beer, or making sure they're not staying up too late or, you know, whatever it is. So usually dinner time, meal time, thinking about food, talking about food is really one of the few joys that the guys really get during the course of their professional lives.
Well, I want to just relate that not just to the pro cyclists, but to your whole concept of how family and meal. You grew up in a family that ate together, and that doesn't seem to happen as much with American families. I don't know how it is in other countries right now, but it seems to me that a lot gets done at that family table.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's you know, it's kind of, for good or bad, you know, there are definitely times when it's stressful and rough because somebody's in trouble or, you know, whatever's happening with the family. But Al and I both grew up immigrant families where food was such an important part of our daily lives, where we just love food and we loved eating. And you'll find that the case with most immigrant families because we have such fond memories of where we just came from or the food that we grew up with, and we want to just relive that every day. And, you know, food is never an afterthought at, you know, first, especially first generation immigrant families. It's always such a part of our life. And I think for people that didn't grow up with that, and there's a huge, you know, movement and people trying to go back to it and try, you know, I know so many people that have weekly friends and family dinners together. And, you know, we, more and more restaurants, even our restaurants, we have community tables everywhere. Just even if it's at a restaurant, the idea that you can sit with people and talk with people, and whether you know them or not, and bring that community sensibility back to eating. And, you know, like, you see athletes, road riders for sure, definitely competitive triathletes. It's a very lonely pursuit. You're training by yourself. You're doing everything by yourself. The race day is literally you by yourself. And it can, at some point, start alienating the rest of the members of your family and the rest of the members of your immediate group. And people don't really understand what it is you're doing. So having some food together, sitting down together once in a while and just remembering that you're still a human being. Yeah, you might be a competitive athlete, but at the end of the day, we're all still humans and we have the basic same needs across the board. Hanging out together, eating a little bit together changes the entire effect of that meal.
Well, you say, and it's a great quote, it's the human part of the human performance equation that matters most. And I think that, you know, taking the food part away and the family part away takes the humanity away in a way.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's, you know, one of Alan's quotes. I mean, I think you and I were talking about this before, but he, you know, writing the recipes and the food part for this book was probably the simplest. Writing food and so writing the food and the recipes and the photography and all that, while it took a lot of work, was probably the simplest part of this whole current book. Alan spent the better part of a year stressing about how to tell the story behind him, looking at historical research going way back into military setup and how the guys would eat together before going into battle, and you know how those little ceremonies were such an integral part of creating some sort of unit cohesion. And you look at the old, you know, the Norman Rockwell era, the 1950s, coming into Leave It to Beaver era, where the family always kind of ate together in this idealized world. But there is something to be said for being able to go home, sit with your friends and family, lick your wounds, plan for the future, come up with what you did wrong, what you're going to do better, you know, instead of just sitting in a corner by yourself and agonizing over how you didn't make it to the podium or whatever the deal
is. Right, right. Let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Chef Bijou Thomas. He is in, you're in Denver today or are you in Boulder?
I am in Denver driving around presently, so I could be anywhere, but I'm mostly in Denver.
Basically, you're in Colorado. We know that. So let's talk a little bit about the book itself, Feed Zone Table, Family Style Meals to Nourish Life and Sport. The recipes are all new, so there are no repeats. There are 100 brand new recipes. You begin with drinks and starters and end with sweets. Tell us a little bit about the ingredients that you recommend, because I know you have a very specific thought on ingredients.
Yeah, the ingredients that we use, whether it's this book or the previous two, have always been really important to me, that whatever ingredients and recipes we create, they had to be something normal, everyday people could find the stuff and make at home, no matter where in the world they live. And as you know, the books are now sold all over the world, and they're translated into a few different languages. And we got, you know, people from young first-time cooks to very professional, serious cooks, and, you know, full spectrum of people that are using the books. So we wanted to make sure that it was accessible and understandable for anybody. We didn't want to put ingredients in there that you couldn't get anywhere, or, you know, just, and even things that are slightly out of the way, we gave solutions and alternatives on how you can make your own version of it to get pretty much the same net effect. Again, we don't use any substitutes for anything. So if we're gonna use fat, we use butter, we use coconut oil, we use obvious everyday fats that are available to people. We don't use sugar substitutes or salt substitutes. We just don't see the point of it, because it's not like you're gonna sit down and eat a pound of butter in one sitting. So why not enjoy real butter if you're gonna have it?
Right.
You know, I mean, if you're eating a pound of butter,
you and I have actually had that exchange either on Facebook or in an email that you said, just eat the butter. It's not gonna hurt you.
Yeah. Well, you don't know what the effect of all the other substitutes and the chemicals and the synthetics are, where you know how butter is going to treat you. Either it works for you or it doesn't work for you. You know, and so we wanted to stick with that. Just stick with things you already know, that you understand, that you grew up eating. Stick with things that aren't artificially colored and flavored, and, you know, you'll notice a difference. Whether it's in your sleep patterns, you know, you notice little allergies going away, you notice whatever it is. It's not like you're all of a sudden you're going to wake up the next day and start, you know, winning at everything you touch. But the little differences, all the little benefits that add up to an overall better quality of life is what we're going for.
So do you have a favorite recipe in this book?
I have so many favorite recipes in this book for different reasons.
Okay. Give us a couple.
Yeah, for the simplicity of it. Like, the one of the prettiest things that we photographed is also the first thing that we photographed for this book, which is there's a chunky guacamole in there.
Oh, I saw really that. Yum, yum.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's basically just chopped up avocados with any fresh, you know, vegetables you can find, all chopped in there. And I finished it with some crispy onions. The whole idea there was that, you know, yeah, we eat guac on chips, but avocados are really nutrient-dense, you know, very satiating, good fats. The texture, it goes with so many things. Why not have it for breakfast, you know, with some eggs? Why not have it the rest of the time instead of just saving it for party time with chips? And by adding some other vegetables and stuff, you change up the textures, you change the flavor, so you can actually, you know, consume it as part of a meal. That's
awesome.
One of my favorites. I might be misquoting the name right now, but the mixed bean curry that I do. So obviously, you know that I've got curry shop restaurants. And I'm
right, we're going to talk about those.
Oh, cool. Yeah, I'm excited for that.
Yeah.
I do a lot of curry-type foods, but the reason we like curry is because it's literally just get some basic curry spice mix you like, you can use all canned beans. Get good quality canned beans, rinse it off, roast your curry, roast whatever vegetables, add a little coconut milk, add the beans in, bring it to a little boil. You're done in basically 10 minutes. You pour it over some rice, pour it over some pasta, whatever you want to do with it, have it as a soup. It's a beautiful dish, and it's so simple and easy to make. And yeah, I just love the simplicity of those dishes that bring a lot of color and different texture.
Well, that, I think, is the hallmark of your cookbooks, is simplicity. And combined with the nutrition, of course, and with the thoughtfulness. And I do want to talk about your restaurants, but before we go to them, I want to talk one more thing about the Feed Zone table, and that is the photography of the people at the table. So there's you, there's Taylor Finney, there's Alan, there are a whole bunch of people. They are some of the best casual photographs I've seen in a long time, and they look like so much fun.
Yeah, they're pretty cool, right? We have so there's two sets of images. There were two photographers, and both the photographers are fashion photographers. And, I mean, they do fashion, mainstream magazines and all that on this go. So if you look at the food shots, they're very beautifully done top-down. A lot of the dishes have burnt marks and splashes and splatters. And, you know, they're very masculine. It's something you would open up, a men's journal or an Esquire or Outside magazine and see like this. It looks like food the way it would look if you made it at home. We didn't dress it up and polish the plates and, present it with these tiny little weird ingredients. And it literally looks like you grabbed it out of your oven. It's burnt on the side. The pan is a little beat up. And those are dishes and pans of ours. So we just left it like that because that's what I wanted it to look like. The group photography we did, each one was at a different setting. We did one at the curry shop. We did one at Alan's house, one at Scratch Labs. And then a friend of ours here in Denver, one of my favorite restaurants in Denver, The Populist. So if you come to Colorado, another thing you should, side note, Curry Shop downtown Denver, the first one that we opened, is in a really cool little neighborhood called Rhino. It's all warehouses and old buildings. Basically every business around there is owned by a cyclist. I mean, like, we all ride together on the weekends.
How cool
is that?
And
we eat. We start and finish rides at each other's restaurants. The Populist is one of the best, one of the original restaurants down there. And Jonathan let us use his patio for the cover shoot of the book, with all the vines and stuff. Alex
nice.
House is in that picture. Damo is in there. And then the rest of the shots are done at these awesome little venues. And it's just basically us hanging out and having dinner parties together.
Yeah, and I know. It looks like fun. It looks like, everybody would want to be there.
That's what we wanted. We wanted people to, and actually Alan's house picture, that really is what it looks like all season long or all year long when Taylor's not away racing. We eat together, two, three times a week whenever we can. There's Scott Berryman's in the picture. For people that grew up back in the 80s and 90s racing, Scott Berryman, he was a superstar on the track.
Right.
I think Lucas is in there. Bjorn Solander's in there. These are all the guys that in Denver and Boulder we see regularly. And Alex House, he was in here washing dishes when I opened the first restaurant last year, along with Keel and Lucas. And, Taylor has come in and painted on the walls in the restaurants. And, these are my regular group of friends that, we just see each other all the time, feed each other all the time, and we wanted to just extend that to the rest of our people that read our books and eat with us and see us on the road.
So let's talk a little bit about Little Curry Shop. So the first one in Denver in the Rhino District is open. It's been open. It's gotten rave reviews. I've had friends go into Denver and have been there, and you are always busy. They felt really badly that they didn't actually get to say hi, and Diane says hi, but they also felt like they couldn't interrupt you. You are always swamped.
Yeah, the Curry Shop downtown's been awesome. We're in an alley in the Rhino neighborhood, which, for people that haven't been here, it's a lot like going into, Brooklyn or Williamsburg maybe 10 years ago, where we still have a bunch of old warehouses, but they're all getting converted into these awesome little breweries and distilleries and restaurants and really cool bike shop called Define Cycles just down the alley from us. So we're in an alley, and Define Cycles is also in the alley. We have a whole wall of old cinder block that has got chalk and paint all over it. And all of that was done by different cyclists as they came through. So there's a great big elephant spray painted on the wall. That's Julian Kyer painted that. Taylor, when he was recovering from his injury last year, he would just come over and go nuts on the wall. So there's Taylor's art all over the place. I think Christian Vandeveld's been in here. George Hincapie's been in here. A bunch of the European dudes last year for Colorado were in there. So it's got a really cool energy and vibe, and it's just simple. You know, it's kind of like if you went to Chipotle and had Indian food, that's the format of the restaurant. But we have beer
quite.
And wine, and we have this whole cycling themed artwork. And,
right.
You know, we have every time you come in, you're going to recognize somebody.
The next two stores are about to open, or they are open?
We're opening the second one. We're opening this Friday, but we're having our first pre-opening party tonight. And then tomorrow we're doing one with World Bicycle Relief. And,
awesome.
You know, the cycling community here in Colorado, we're doing that. And then Friday we open. On the 1st of April, and then the 18th of April, we open in Boulder, inside Whole Foods in Boulder.
Oh, inside of Whole Foods. How interesting.
I know, right?
One of
the U.S. to open.
Yeah, no, that's a really cool idea. We have something that used to be called the Osteria. Now they renamed it the Kitchen Counter, where we eat a lot. But, wow, how cool would it be to have a little curry shop inside our Whole Foods here? That would be awesome.
We're working on it. That's the idea. We're going to do two of them here this summer in Colorado. And then if people go for it, we're looking at bringing them to a neighborhood.
Well, to a neighborhood near me, that would be really awesome.
Exactly.
So, like, you have nothing more to do. What else is on yours and Alan's schedule this year besides opening more restaurants? Are you traveling?
I will not be traveling anytime in the near future. We're doing a little bit of the book promo stuff. I need to get through the month of April before I can see straight.
Yeah.
Al's out doing Ride on Atlanta right now. So he's out there with Tim Johnson and the People for Bikes group.
Oh, cool.
Scratch Labs truck and trailer. They're doing that whole great big ride right now.
Right.
Al's out there on the road right now riding, and then I'm doing a few events. I'm basically staying close to home and cooking and doing a few cycling events where I can jump in and, you know,
and
actually contribute something.
Sure. So let's let our listeners know where they can get a copy of the Feed Zone Table, the new book. It is a beautiful book. It's so well done.
Thank you, Diane. The books, first and foremost, you can get them at scratchlabs.com. And we're usually running some promo or another. Just go to Scratch Labs website. You can also find them at Whole Foods around the country, REI stores. Most every bicycle and running triathlon store in the U.S. has them. Barnes & Noble has them. You can also buy them online, but definitely do Scratch or go support one of your local bike shops. They're awesome, you know, resource to have in your neighborhood. Go buy it there, or I would, you know, of course want you to buy it from Scratch. But
of course,
if not, go talk to your local shop and carry it if they don't already have it.
Well, thanks for taking time out of your insanely busy schedule to talk with me about the book and about cycling and about just the world of Bijou and the little curry shops. I just can't wait to try one.
Thank you, Diane.
All
Thank
right.
you so much.
Have a good day.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Chef Bijou Thomas joined me from his car. He's driving around Denver getting ready to open his second little curry shop in the area. He was talking to me about his new book, The Feed Zone Table. Always an interesting conversation. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be back with some news. You are listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
We'd like to thank our podcast sponsor, Dodd Camera, for their support of The Outspoken Cyclist. There is a close relationship between cycling and photography, and we're proud to have this family-owned business as a partner in our show. If you're in the market for photo equipment, want to learn more about taking great pictures, or maybe you're ready to launch your own YouTube channel, visit doddcamera.com and see what Dodd Camera can do for you.
We are back on The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Lees, and I'm going to deliver a little bit of news by myself this week since Tim is off. This comes out of Interbike, which is the big trade show that is normally held in Las Vegas every year. The organization, though, is out of San Juan Capistrano. This was released on March 24th. And in recognition of the growing interest in U.S. manufacturing, Interbike, the largest bicycle industry trade show in North America, announced a new featured showcase area and dedicated neighborhood on the show floor of the upcoming event to raise the profile of domestic manufacturers. So when you go to Interbike, you'll see that there are sort of areas, like there's an Italian area and there's a new bike area. So now evidently there's going to be a domestic manufacturing area. Attendees will be able to learn more about selected U.S.-made products in a professionally merchandised showcase prominently located at the front of Hall C. The products profiled will have been reviewed and met Interbike's Made in America criteria. The review process that will be used is based specifically on the Federal Trade Commission's Made in USA standard. In addition to the showcase area, the Interbike is creating a new community area of Made in America brands on the show floor. To participate in the area, companies must also submit an application and must be able to demonstrate that more than 65% of their products are made domestically. So that should be an interesting possibility for some American manufacturers to be showcased at the trade show. I'm going to move on to talk about some Rails to Trails stuff. The Dopelt Family Trail Development Fund, Rails to Trails launched a new grant program in 2015 to support organizations and local governments that are implementing projects to build and improve rail trails. Under the Dopelt Family Trail Development Fund, RTC will award a total of $85,000 per year for the next 5 years to qualifying projects through a competitive process. The fund was established with an $80,000 grant from Jeff Dopelt of Great Neck, New York, a longtime supporter of RTC and development of trails in the U.S., and an additional $20,000 donation from an anonymous donor. That's pretty cool to be able to apply for those grants. Applications for 2016 were closed January 31st, but they're going to reopen the grant process fairly soon. So I'd watch the railstotrails.org website to find out more about it. And we'll see which grants are awarded this year and see who gets them. This is a big, big coup for women. We talked last week about women getting more money in cycling, but this comes from BikeRadar.com. Women promised bumper prize money at Ride London Classique. It is a landmark moment for women's pro touring in the world event. So the prize money for the UCI Women's World Tour event at Prudential Ride London will match that promised for the men's race the following day. The new Ride London Classique has a prize pool of £100,000 each for men's and women's races and becomes the highest ever offered for a woman's one-day race. The women's race will be held on Saturday, July 30th, with the men's following on July 31st. Both will be televised live by BBC Sport, which is pretty cool. Prudential Ride London has set new records for cycling every year, said Brian Cookson, the president of governing body, the UCI. It is the biggest festival of cycling in the world. It is wonderful to see that the new UCI Women's World Tour race has been awarded full parity with the men's event. Hear, hear. That is just awesome. We are so happy to hear that. So in continuing with the kind of cycling partnership in the racing end, March 29th, this came out of USA Cycling. They announced that it extended its partnership with Volkswagen as the official automotive partner through February 2017, continuing a relationship that began in 2012. We are thrilled to continue our partnership with Volkswagen as we head into an Olympic year and are doubling our efforts in support of grassroots development and amateur racing, said USA Cycling CEO Derek Bouchard-Hall, with whom we spoke not too long ago. Volkswagen has been a superb partner these last 4 years and has provided immense benefit to the American cycling community. We stand by them today, as they stood by our sport as it struggled with its challenges. With VW by our sides, we will be able to make immense progress toward the goals USA Cycling's membership cares most about. So Volkswagen is delighted to renew our partnership with USA Cycling, said Vinay Shahani, Vice President of Marketing, Volkswagen of America. This relationship reflects the passion that many of our owners have for cycling and illustrates the way our cars help people participate in a sport they love. So, you know, both organizations have had their issues recently. Hopefully they will come to help each other out in the 2016 cycling season. April 9th through 12th will be the fourth year that Team 26, a group of 26 riders, will leave Sandy Hook, Connecticut to ride the 400-mile route to Washington, D.C. They are riding to honor victims of gun violence, to raise awareness of the public health crisis of gun violence, and to support common sense measures to reduce it. So for more information on the ride, you can go to their Facebook page, Sandy Hook Ride on Washington. Again, April 9th through 12th. I think it's an interesting cause. They have beautiful jackets. And this, again, is the fourth year. So in a no big surprise follow-up to our story about the Playboy e-bike specialized unveiled at the bike show in Berlin, Germany, Road.cc reports this week that Specialized will not sell this bike at all. Big surprise. U.S. brand Specialized has confirmed to Road.cc that the controversial limited edition Playboy electric bike it unveiled at a bike show in Berlin earlier this month will not be on public sale because it, quote, does not align with our brand values, end quote. The Morgan Hill, California-based company had been accused of sexism after pictures were circulated on social media the weekend before last of two women dressed as Playboy bunnies promoting the bike at a trade show. Some 40 examples of the black and gold e-bike were offered for sale on the German market, but in an emailed statement, the company told Road.cc, the limited edition Turbo in collaboration with Playboy will not be sold. We are a brand for all riders and acknowledge this brand partnership does not align with our values. Specialized had already apologized for the PR stunt, with Chief Marketing Officer Slate Olson saying the brand, quote, stands strong with female riders and we do not support the objectification of women in any way in any region, end quote. The company added that this market activation was carried out locally by the regional marketing manager and was not discussed with or approved by their global marketing team. So that probably ends it for now. But as Tim and I told you last week, perhaps eventually we're going to come up with an apology first and an ad and a product later. So this was one of my favorite items of the week. Velo Minotti, with their tongue-in-cheek just firmly planted, decided to come out with their sock height calculator. It is replete with an amazing graphic. It's just beautiful. There was a time, as many of us will remember, when it was only black shorts, white socks, and whatever color jersey your team gave you. So today, it's a pretty crazy world when you look at some of the kits that are out there. So Velo Minotti Sock Height Calculator, Refining the Goldilocks Principle. It's by Gianni. It's from March 25th. There are 74 responses to it at the last time I looked, which was hilarious. And what they're saying is that Winnipeg Cycling Chick's stellar treatise on sock height should be required reading for everyone, even non-cyclists. People should have this knowledge. Why, I don't know, but whatever. While we have lost the battle on sock color, the final battles on height continues. We can use the VSP generator between VSP runs to work on other important first world problems. Oh, I see. Okay. So while the Velo Minotti people are working on other world problems, we can just use their calculator to figure out our sock height. To this end, straight out of the Velo Minotti bunker, we have the sock height calculator. Okay, let me read you the equation. S equals A divided by pi minus the square root of B plus or minus B over A divided by 1 over CS to the first power. A equals the lower leg length measured from inner ankle protuberance to top of the inner tibia in centimeters. B is the distance between inner ankle protuberance to the bottom of the calf in centimeters. And it goes on and on and on. It's really funny. The graphic is beautiful. So, yes, if you would like to see it, you could go to velominati.com and take a look at their sock height calculator. So, as many of you know, we are leaving for Ridgeland, Mississippi, but we are also going to be going to New Orleans. So I thought I'd give a little shout out to the Bike Easy Group. In addition to NOLA, so now we have to be New Orleans people. NOLA is the acronym for New Orleans, Louisiana. In addition to their Bike to Work Week, which is coming up April 11th, Bike Easy promotes a whole slew of bike programs, from community bike workshops and bike valet services to a youth ambassador program and the city's bike share. So if you're visiting, like we will be, maybe check out all the bike advocacy stuff that's related on their website at bikeeasy.org. So my favorite video of the week, which Tim usually does, is about beer. Now, bikes and beer go together. This has nothing to do with bikes other than the fact that bikes and beer go together. But it is short and to the point. It is Pour, P-O-U-R, Biotics from ScienceGasm, spelled exactly the way it sounds, on Facebook. It gives us a 41-second look at an automatic beer pouring machine. It offers a perfect head, no spillage. It's very quiet. Some of the comments, though, were hilarious. And my favorite was, if you're too drunk to pour yourself a beer, you're probably too drunk to work the machine. So that might have some merit, but it is very clever. It's, you got to see it to understand what I'm saying. So my last item of the week is from an article from lifehack.org by Jocelyn Jones. It's titled Science Explains How Cycling Changes Your Brain and Makes You Mentally Stronger. So research has shown that incorporating cycling into your daily routine is not only healthy for your body, but also your brain. If you have ever cycled to work and noticed that your mood and mental capabilities felt better than normal, you were actually experiencing the proven benefits of cycling on mental health. Many people have taken up cycling as a way to get in shape and live a healthier lifestyle. However, even those who already enjoyed good physical health can improve their mental strength through cycling regularly. A mere 30 minutes of steady cycling on the road, trail, or a stationary bike can improve memory, reasoning, and planning. It also has scientifically proven benefits for emotional health, helping combat depression and anxiety. So before I go on with any more of this article, which is quite lengthy and very, very good, I want to say that I have been thanked by more than one spouse, both men and women, about how having them get their new bike has made such a difference in their lives. And I know a lot of people use their bikes to decompress. I think it's a really good idea. One is called Your Brain on Biking. So it says that cycling can grow your brain in the same way it can grow your muscles. And when we cycle, the blood that flows to the muscles increases, allowing your bodies to build more capillaries. And it goes on to explain that. Then it talks about cycling shifts our mental well-being. People of all ages can experience the benefits of cycling on psychological well-being, regardless of your physical health. It can improve one's self-perception and sense of self-worth, resulting in higher self-esteem. Studies have shown that these improvements were even stronger for mental health patients, people suffering from mild depression. And then it also says doctor's orders for cyclists. How much should we cycle to take full advantage of the benefits it can provide? It is true that cycling with too much intensity can begin to reduce our energy as our bodies become depleted of nutrients. That said, how much cycling is enough to enjoy its benefits before it begins to take too much of a toll on us? Scientists suggest that 30 to 60 minutes of steady riding at a good pace, no sprinting, is a good balance. Maintaining a heart rate of roughly 75% of max is also suggested. Think of it as a 7 out of 10 on a scale of no activity to cycled so hard I can barely breathe. This is a general guideline for the average person, so ultimately it is important to cycle to fit one's ability. It is again an article from lifehack.org by Jocelyn Jones titled Science Explains How Cycling Changes Your Brain and Makes You Mentally Stronger. So that's our news for this week. We are going to take a break and come back so that we can go down to South Carolina and talk to our good buddy Dan Worry about what's going on in the Peloton. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. Hi, Dan. Welcome back to The Outspoken Cyclist.
Hi, Diane. It's great to be back with you.
Oh, good. Is it nice down there?
It's beautiful. Sunny, yeah. South Carolina in April, almost.
Yeah, how much worse could it be, right? So we're heading for Ridgeland, Tennessee for a tandem rally this coming weekend.
Oh, it should be beautiful.
I am hoping for that, yes. Anyway, I really don't like beginning conversations with a tragedy, but there has been the loss of another pro cyclist in the Peloton. It's really getting kind of scary for the world of cycling. Tell us a little bit about what happened to Antoine, I think it's Demoutier.
I believe it is. Some of these European names are challenging for us all, particularly when we aren't accustomed to hearing them on televised means. Actually, believe it or not, Diane, we actually had two deaths this past weekend.
That's right.
That stemmed from pro cycling, and so yeah, very very difficult situation. You know, the first of those, Antoine Demoutier, as you mentioned, is a 25-year-old Belgian cyclist for the Wanty Groupe Gobert UCI Pro Continental team. He was racing at the one-day Gent-Wevelgem race in Belgium, and unfortunately suffered a collision with one of the race officials' motorcycles, as we understand it at this point. The details are a little bit sketchy, but you know, this goes back, I think, to some of our past conversations about, you know, kind of a rash of moto on cyclists, collisions that have been happening here over the past year or so in particular. But Demoutier, was chasing back onto a group, and as we understand it, was going about 70 kilometers an hour, slightly downhill, was being followed by a race official on a motorcycle. His bike went down, and, you know, the speed and the proximity of those two were such that the race official wasn't able to avoid him, after he went down, and so was in intensive care and passed away late Sunday. Just tragic to see a young guy, at this age, a budding career in pro cycling, and to have a loss like this is just amazing. And then, you know, we also had a cyclist at the Criterium International in Corsica this past weekend, Dan Mongier, I believe is the way his name is pronounced, but this was a less violent issue, but he suffered a heart attack after having dropped off of that group there about 20 kilometers from the finish, was struggling and was picked up by an ambulance and suffered a heart attack in the ambulance afterward. And so, they're looking into that, but that was not not an accident, but related, I guess, to exertion.
I'll tell you, it's just been scary, terrifying to see this. Also what happened, and I think this was within the last 2 weeks, there's a gentleman who was a pro cyclist. He was riding with a group of riders in Colorado. Yes. I guess he T-boned something, and he lost an arm. Phil Zajacek?
Phil Zajacek, yes.
Zajacek.
Is a former pro cyclist, was riding in Boulder, Colorado, and coming down one of the very well-known climbs there. It's a little unclear, sort of like this, this crash at Gent-Wevelgem, not all of the details are super well-known. The suggestion is that someone, whether he or a driver, crossed the center line, at high speed coming down, this descent and, managed to collide with what I understood to be a flatbed truck. And so, yes, Phil is still in the hospital, as I understand it, in a medically induced coma, and, lost an arm in this collision. And I think they're still sort of assessing the broader damage. So, just a tragic couple of weeks.
Well, we in the media, unfortunately, have to report on this stuff. We are not supposed to have opinions, but I think I want to go there.
All right.
So let's talk a little bit about what you think. And I mean, you're seeing this, I'm seeing this. Bob Rohl had some really, he was so sad when he reported on Antoine Demoutier on his little TV commentary thing. He's saying, you got to be safe out there. How can we start ensuring safety?
Well, this is a tough question, because, the sport is inherently inherently dangerous. The most recent death, or at least high-profile death in the peloton, was Wouter Weiland back at the Giro d'Italia a couple of years ago. Crashed on a descent. There was nothing else involved other than just a horrific kind of high-speed crash. The cycling will always have an element of danger to it, unfortunately. And so, particularly in a race situation, it's a little hard to to figure out how to address some of that. In the case of what happened at Gentwellersham, though, I think, you know, there is a lot of discussion and frankly a lot of anger going on right now in terms of whether or not an accident like this one really could have been avoidable. And you know, we've talked so many times here, you know, you and I have even talked in the past. You know, we had issues at the Vuelta a España last year with Peter Sagan,
right,
being taken out by a race moto. Obviously Taylor Finney at U.S. Nationals in Chattanooga, Tennessee a couple of years back. Did not collide with a race moto, but, you know, suffered a horrible injury that was, you know, arguably caused by the presence of a race moto in the field. And so, you know, there is a lot of discussion going on right now, Diane, about what needs to be done to reform the sport, particularly in regards to the participation of race motos. Brian Cookson, who is the president of the UCI, you know, wrote an open letter to fans and teams here in the past couple of days, kind of urging patience and that we not jump to conclusions, but also assuring that, you know, that he's going to take this situation seriously. You know, we do know that there were more than 60 race motos involved in Gent-Wevelgem here this past weekend. And so, you know, one of the things that is being bandied about is this question of whether there need to be more limits on the number of race vehicles that travel in that caravan. If anyone has ever you know, traveled as part of that, you know, in a race vehicle, it's a very hairy thing. I mean, these cyclists are moving at high speed. The race caravan is moving at high speed, and you know, particularly around the riders, there is an effort to, you know, make sure those vehicles are near the riders as briefly as possible. And so, you know, I've certainly seen situations where race motorcycles have, you know, gone zipping by at incredibly high speeds. You know, very close to the riders. So, you know, there are probably some common sense sorts of things that I think will result from this. Definitely a review of how these, you know, how these motos and other race vehicles participate. You know, I mean, something as simple as having some speed limits,
right,
involved, you know, and having some mandatory kind of minimum distance between, you know, how close a race vehicle can actually be to a rider. Now, you know, anyone who has, you know, ever watched even televised coverage of the climbs of the Tour de France knows that, you know, sometimes they're traveling through incredibly tight spaces with fans and, you know, cars lining the path. I mean, you know, those may be somewhat difficult to enforce, but, you know, there are, I think, some reforms that we'll probably see coming out of these tragedies. Yeah, more training. You know, this is a very specialized way of traveling. You know, these motorbike pilots, as they call them in Europe. You know, these guys are real pros. I mean, it's easy to sort of jump to conclusions about, you know, the qualifications of the moto drivers in this case, but, you know, our understanding at this point is that this is somebody who had loads and loads of experience. This was not a press photographer. I mean, this was a race officials moto driven by somebody who had years and years of experience in you know, some of the biggest races in the world. And so, you know, even in that regard, it's hard to say that more training
would have
prevented this particular accident, because by most accounts, there really was nothing that the driver could have done at this point to avoid hitting the rider. But, you know, the question of the proximity and the speed and, you know, all of that, just as a general rule within the peloton, is something that I think we're going to see reexamined as a result.
Well, it just seems that if you have, say, 100 riders and 60 motorbikes, it seems like maybe, you know, there are, and the roads especially are so narrow, and then you have spectators sticking stuff into the, you know, there are a whole lot of things about cycling that are inherently dangerous, not to mention the machine itself. But then you have all these extraneous factors. You begin to wonder who's going to be willing, although I guess there's still a lot of people willing to get on a bike and race. It's pretty interesting.
Definitely so, but yeah, I mean, this is unusual. I mean, to have, you know, and this is a combination of a couple of different accidents. I mean, one was a, you know, one that we're talking about with Phil Zychek is obviously a recreational kind of accident out on open roads. The other two definitely took place as part of a closed, professional road race kind of setting. The heart attack. I'm not sure how. That's just an unfortunate kind
right.
of situation that maybe reform couldn't prevent. But this issue with the race motos in particular, I think is going to really get some attention here.
Let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Dan Worry. He's down in South Carolina, and we're talking about some of the incidents that occurred in the last week in the Spring Classic, which brings me to my next topic, which is the Spring Classics. How are they going?
They're fascinating as always. This is my favorite time of year in the in the pro racing calendar. We are coming up on what many consider the two biggest one day races in the sport, the Tour of Flanders coming up this Sunday in Belgium, and then the following weekend Paris-Roubaix. So the two biggest cobbled classics are on the way. I think the big stories here are the question of Fabian Cancellara's participation. This is he has announced that this is his last year riding professionally. He is one of, if not the most accomplished one day rider, certainly of his generation, and maybe within the history of the sport. And so I think a lot of people are eyeing carefully whether or not Cancellara will come back and take a big win at either Flanders-Roubaix or both. Another big story that is emerging, I don't know, Diane, how much you have followed the story of Greg Van Avermaet. He is a Belgian cyclist on Team BMC.
Yes.
He is a cyclist that has had, without doubt, a ton of success, and has been, it's sort of like close but no cigar.
Right, eluded that
Greg,
top spot.
Greg Van Avermaet is along with Peter Sagan, is sort of famous for his second and third place finishes. He's always seemed to be here in recent years kind of right there in the mix, but has not managed to put together wins. And boy, Van Avermaet is really coming alive here. He won the Omloop Het Nieuwsblad here a couple of weeks ago. He then also took a win at the Tirreno Adriatico, which is a multi-day stage race. So he appears to be in the form of his life. And so, I think he's definitely somebody to watch at both Flanders and Roubaix, obviously, as is Peter Sagan, who took a win last weekend at Gent-Wevelgem in the World Champions jersey.
Right, how cool was that?
Very cool.
Were you in Richmond?
I was not able to be in Richmond.
Me
unfortunately,
neither.
No. So,
but boy, I watched it. I don't think anybody. It was one of the most amazing finishes ever.
It really was an exciting finish.
So, moving on to post Spring Classics. How do you see any big changes in sort of the standings, the people? I mean, we're watching people like Quintana, and now we're Quintana. We're watching a whole bunch of people. Anybody looking really, really good for the tour this year for you?
It's always a little bit difficult to say this time of year. The Grand Tour, GC captains tend not to be really flexing their muscle at this time of year because they're kind of saving things up to peak later in the summer. But, obviously Alberto Contador has looked very strong already early this season. Chris Froome has looked good. Nairo Quintana has looked good. So, I expect, barring injury, that we're looking at a battle between those guys again. And then, Astana's Vincenzo Nibali is certainly back in the mix. And, he had, after winning the Tour de France a couple of years back, had a terrible showing here more recently. And so I think that has sort of, I don't know if that's lit a fire under him, but he sure had a very strong end of the season and seems to be raring to go this year as well. So, he'll be another one to watch.
Well, are you working on any other big stories right now? I know you write your column for Velo News, which is such a wonderful column. It's so much fun to read.
Thank you. The most recent column, I'll give you a teaser on the one
good.
That's coming up that actually relates to Fabian Cancellara. I basically beg him not to retire. I mean, I just I think, obviously a little bit tongue-in-cheek, I think he has pretty well decided that the time has come. But, you know, it's hard, Diane, to watch somebody as accomplished as Cancellara performing as well as he is. You know, he's still right up there in the mix in the biggest races in the world, and so to see somebody in that kind of form looking at leaving the sport at this point is just a tough one for fans. So that's on tap in Villeneuve.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I guess there's the philosophy that you want to go out on top as opposed to on the bottom. There is something to be said for that, to retire with your laurels instead of underneath them or whatever.
Definitely so, but boy, it'll be a loss to the sport. Particularly fans of the Spring Classics are going to miss Cancellara, something awful.
What do you think Taylor's going to do this year? How's he looking?
Well, you know, that's an interesting story. I'm glad you brought that up. I don't know if you have seen, but Taylor Finney has actually been added by BMC to the Tour of Flanders squad.
Ooh, no, I didn't see that.
He expressed himself a little bit of surprise that they had chosen to put him in, such a big race at this point in his recovery. But I don't know how much we ought to expect of Taylor at Flanders. But you know, as someone, and you and I have discussed this a couple of times. You know, I was there on scene in Chattanooga. Covering U.S. Nationals when he suffered that horrific crash. And, you know, there was a period of time, candidly, where, you know, I mean, the scuttlebutt was even that, you know, this question of whether Finney was going to make it back onto a bike professionally.
Right.
And so to have seen the success that he's had, you know, jumping back into the sport after a very prolonged recovery, and now to see him, you know, put back into the mix at the biggest races in the world is just really phenomenal. It's a great thing for American cycling fans in particular.
Last thing I want to talk about is Rio. So,
yes.
So Taylor is supposed to maybe go what time trial, right?
Potentially so. Yeah, I mean, I think we got to see how all of that shakes out. There are certain secure places that they qualify for, and then there are some coaches' picks that happen. So we don't know entirely who is going at this point to Rio, but it's certainly coming up. I think the other interesting story about Rio coming up is the emergence of this Zika virus, where they're sort of starting to caution athletes about whether they really want to go and participate. I'm not sure that we'll see that. You know, I mean, for these athletes, the dream of making it to the Olympics is something that has been such a part of their lives and careers that I have a little bit of difficulty imagining they're going to forego that opportunity because of this health threat. But, it's certainly something that we're watching.
Well, Taylor in particular has parents who are Olympians. So, you know, to pass that up as an opportunity probably would be really hard for him at this point.
I would think so. So
yeah.
We'll have to see. I think whether he makes that squad at this point, kind of in his recovery, is a little bit unknown. But boy, it'd be great to see.
Yes, it would. Well, I really appreciate you taking time to talk with me. Unfortunately, we had to start with, a couple of tragedies, but we ended up on a high note. So I'm pretty pleased with that.
Absolutely.
All right.
Always a pleasure.
And have a wonderful day. Enjoy the sunshine, and we'll talk again.
Thanks, Dan.
Alrighty. Bye-bye. Dan Woori joined me from his home in South Carolina talking about cycling crashes that resulted in tragedy and about the Olympics that might result in victory. So that is our show for this week. I hope you enjoyed my interview with Chef Bijou Thomas. Again, if you're up in the Denver or Boulder area, you know, maybe you want to check out the Little Curry Shop. It gets rave reviews from the people I know who have been there. And, of course, Dan, read his new column in Velo News on the back page. Have a great day. If you have a chance, go for a ride. There will be no new Outspoken Cyclist show next week. I will be, as we said, in Ridgeland, Mississippi for the OBO Tandem Rally. We'll be back in 2 weeks. Next week, we'll have an encore presentation. Thanks so much for listening. Have a great day. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Lees. We'll be back next week at this same time with more conversation and news from the world of cycling. If you missed any part of today's show, download the podcast from iTunes or WJCU.org. And you can follow the Outspoken Cyclist on Facebook and Twitter to keep the conversation going throughout the week. The Outspoken Cyclist is a copyrighted production of DBL Promotions with the assistance of WJCU FM Cleveland, a service of John Carroll University. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.